It's not going to be a doctor or a social worker or politicians or business leaders that will teach you to get proud. You know, it's not going to be your parents or your teachers or the man down the street. Like, the only way you get proud is by practicing.
We tell stories to share the human experience.
No matter what form it takes.
Actor, photographer, theatre maker, musician, whoever is trying to be heard.
We can't stop telling stories. There's no end to them.
By telling stories, we connect to each other and create a sense of community.
This is an opportunity to share stories from a talented and diverse range of individuals, in the hope it provides inspiration and knowledge.
This is a podcast about Australian storytelling in all its forms, hosted by two Australians in the arts industry.
Welcome to the Act of Storytelling.
Hi, everybody.
I'm Lauren Bailey.
And I'm Nick Kane.
And welcome to podcast 27.
First of all, we would like to show our respect and acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, of elders past and present, on which this podcast is recorded today.
Yes, and it is a beautiful patch of land that I am recording on in Melbourne today. It is sunny springtime, which is a wonderful time of year.
New beginnings.
And it is new beginnings. Is it?
You know, spring is one of those things where it's like you've got all the beautiful plant life springing out from its seeds.
Actually, vague? I'm going to use that later for a segue. Can you use something later for a segue? I am going to do that because I'm making the rules, or we are making the rules on this podcast. Anyway, the clocks have changed. It's daylight savings.
It is.
The sun is shining. There is a note on this saying something about you will cut in at this point with your extensive wit. Please do.
I've already used my extensive wit. It fell a little flat, I'm not going to lie.
So, well, something that is quite exciting is the fact that we have collaborated with one of our wonderful podcast guests. You may remember the very brilliant visual artist Bethany Smith, who has kindly helped us create a bookmark, I was waiting for the drum roll. If you imagine me, Donald, which is something that we would like to give to our listeners to thank you for your support and for tuning in each month to hear what we've got to say. And of course, it's also an effort to help us continue to be able to bring the podcast to you guys. We are nearly at the end of our third year, but we do want to keep this completely independent, and we do need some help to do that. Mm-hmm. So we will be going live with our wonderful gift from Bethany Smith not long after we go live with this podcast, and we'll also be setting up a platform through the website for you to be able to contribute to our work.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that the bookmark is a beautiful piece in itself, but also that the money that you help or that you contribute goes to making this podcast possible. We do appreciate your support in advance, and it's a pretty cool bookmark.
We are pretty excited about the whole thing. In the meantime, let's talk about the last month.
Also, the last podcast. We've just come off the back of Elka Berry's podcast. Did you have any thoughts that came through from last month's podcast that you've woven into your month this month, Lauren?
Yeah, actually, it's interesting because that's very much what has happened for me. We do these amazing interviews. We always have significant takeaways. And then we talk about, what we're doing next. So it leads me directly back into my career and my life to think about how other storytellers' practices and ideologies affect my own processes. Well, there's three big words. And
in a row.
Let me make some sense here. But I felt really inspired after talking to Elka last month. How to make this make sense? Okay, let's take this back. The reason for me, for why we started this podcast, this is how far we're going back, was to strengthen the artistic community in Australia. But we also want to create this sense that artists aren't alone and we can hear about what other people are going through, and that will help us. And this month I'm ongoing listening to the Inside Acting podcast, which is one of the things that initially inspired us.
Yes.
But I also, Andrew McCannon put me onto the Honest Actors podcast, which is...
Yeah, I did see that.
Yeah, yes. It comes out of the UK, and it's actors being very honest about their challenges. And that's really nice to hear, just other people going through that journey. So in this part of the intro for the podcast, I wanted to talk about where I've been at this month, and it is bringing in some of Elko's motivation and this thing of seasonality. And I always talk about living intentionally, and at the very end of the last podcast, I said, okay, I feel like tomorrow is a new day, the cast and crew screening will have happened, and I'm going to figure out what happens next and how to live intentionally. And that's pretty much what I'm doing. What does that mean? Am I looking forward or back, or am I just being present? If I'm aligning myself, I feel like as a storyteller, to try and achieve what I want to achieve, that I am diversifying filmmaking, writing, podcasting, as well as my acting, which is, you know, my main passion. But if I'm doing those things, how am I aligning them? Because some people say that you should just focus on the one thing you want. And if I really am honest about what the one thing I want is, it's to be an actor.
Yeah.
And
I also think that this statement of people saying that there's one thing you should focus on is very subjective.
Absolutely.
If there's one thing we've learned from this podcast, it's that there's many different views and many different ways to make things work as a storyteller.
That's beautiful that you say that, Nick. I think that's completely true. So it's been more like 6 weeks. Going into those 6 weeks with Elka's positivity and seeing obstacles in life as positive things, how to view rejection as just another reason to move forward or work towards what you want. I got to the point in the middle of these 6 weeks, and I mentioned it to you and the blogging team, Nick, that I looked back at my year and I feel like I have just put so much creativity and passion and energy and into this year, and it's been amazing, and I feel really positive about that, and I've done lots of auditioning. But if I actually look at how many days I've spent on set or in rehearsing in a theatre this year, it's not very much. So how do I internalize that? What does that mean to me? And I'm posing questions rather than answers.
And you have to pose questions. It's that time of the year, and we know this, especially as actors, but I think it goes across many industries. As we start to come to the end of the year, things slowly start to, I guess, slow down as far as, you know, there's not as many auditions. People are starting to get into Christmas mode, holidays start happening. So it becomes a time of sometimes introspection and going, right, what was the year that was and what is the year that is going to be?
Yeah.
And taking that time to set up. And that's not always easy.
Well, I find that hard too, because I don't like to think that we're bound by this idea of what a year is, and that I need to now go, oh, well, it's October, the industry's shutting down, so therefore I'm not going to achieve what I wanted to achieve this year.
Yeah.
Done deal. In winter, we hibernate and we look inside ourselves and we learn stuff. And now it's spring and it is about new beginnings. But we need to remember what we found within ourselves. And I went back and I read something I wrote in a journal earlier in the year. And even listening to last month's podcast, the frame of mind I was in then, it's different to now. But what can I take from that? And I think the answer is within us. I think that's my month. And that's a very long discussion about
that's me. That's beautiful. I think it's a discussion that a lot of people will be having right now. And I just wrote down, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, which is kind of what you were getting at around you learning things, and you should be layering these things rather than going, rightio, new direction, I'm going this way and I'm leaving all my tools behind and I'm running naked left rather than going right or whatever it is. That's a very visual analogy for everyone. 2017 will be me running naked down an alleyway. So there you go.
Fantastic.
No. No.
I would really love to hear. I know we always welcome hearing from listeners, but if anyone has any insight on this, I'd love to hear about your process and what keeps you alive and, you know, doing your stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very anyway, and more than enough about me. What's been happening in your head, Nick?
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because I think everything that you're going through, I think it's a universal thing for artists to go through at this time of year. But some other things that are going on for me, just to step away from what we were talking about there, is Shining City, the show that I'm performing in for Q44 in November, has begun rehearsing.
Oh, fantastic.
It has, but it's such a strange process to be in Sydney and know that your fellow actors and director are in Melbourne doing all this amazing work and then sitting here and obviously there's constant communication, but it just feels at this point like I'm so far away. And I spoke last month about the inner activists, and this particular show brings out some strong themes that I feel quite passionate about, both externally that people will know about once they see the show, but also internally and just the things that I'm working through. And being in alignment not only with the character and the show and your fellow actors, but also yourself.
Yeah.
To ensure that as an artist and a storyteller, you're communicating as truthfully as you possibly can. So I'm working through that because there's so much going on for me. You know, I'm getting married, and depending on when you listen to this podcast, of course, I'll be getting married about 5 days after this goes live. So I have been spending a lot of time focusing on family as well, which is a beautiful thing to do. But when you're an individual like me that loves to work and loves to, you know, just go headfirst into work, it's really strange to be taking that time. It almost feels self-indulgent to be spending the time with the family, and it shouldn't. So finding that alignment of allowing myself to move between the different spheres is...
And I definitely think your level of awareness of all of that is a real strength.
Because it is important, and family, I think it's for most people, not all people, but family's of utmost importance to me. So ensuring that there's enough time for that, and obviously it's just really important to me. So there's that as well. I did want to, and I did sort of digress slightly, but I did want to give a quick plug to Shining City. So Shining City, if you want to come and see some wonderful work, not necessarily by me, but by the whole
who have we got? Who's in there?
So we've got Anthony Scundi, Sebastian Gunner, Madeline Claire French, and of course the wonderful Gabby Rose Carter directing the show. It's in the beautiful Q44 Theatre, that beautiful small theatre.
Such a great space.
It is. It's a very interesting space.
And they use it just so cleverly. Each time you go in there, it's completely transformed.
And once again, it's going to be transformed for this show. So level 1, 550 Swan Street in Richmond. The show will be running from November 8th to the 27th. The show's 7:30 p.m. Wednesday to Saturday and then 6 p.m. on the Sunday. And you get a ticket for $35 off the website.
And can I just say, I'm really glad I'm on Skype right now, because otherwise you might reach across and slap me with this suggestion. Yeah. But I realise you're about to get married and then you're going straight into rehearsal, so you probably don't have heaps of spare time on your hands. But it would be great if we could maybe line up a couple of members of the cast and do a quick storyteller snapshot just to talk about Gabby's... such an amazing director, and we've obviously had her as a guest on the podcast, so it would be really great to get some insight while you guys are rehearsing.
I would love to do that, because there's some really amazing, interesting things coming out of it too, because Connor McPherson, the playwright, is brilliant. There is actually a quote about this show that it says it's as close to perfection as contemporary playwriting gets. So really exciting. So let's do that.
Okay,
let's
fantastic.
Do a storyteller snapshot.
Great. So I just wanted to remind people, we have a feedback survey that is pinned on our Facebook page and on every podcast page on the website that we would love, love, love for you to fill out and let us know what sorts of questions should we be asking our guests, and what do you want to hear and what's important to you on your storytelling journey. And if you listen to us through iTunes, you know, subscribe to the feed. That would be brilliant. Anything like that would just be really helpful. So.
It all makes a difference. So go and do that, and then listen to the next part of the podcast, the interview, podcast 27, Mr. Bryce Arps.
Hi, everybody. I am joined here today in Melbourne by Bryce Ives, theatre and media producer, arts facilitator, performer, broadcaster, director, person. That's your intro, Bryce. And Nick, you are joining us via Skype from your home base in Sydney.
Yes, I am. So welcome, Bryce. How are you today?
I am so excited because the Bulldogs won the grand final.
It's a great time to be in Yarraville, I'm sure.
It's a great time to be alive.
You and Lauren are sitting in this beautiful studio, and it's your studio. Can you tell us a little bit about the location and what it means to you?
So I've lived here for 5 years, and it's an old butcher's shop. And in this place, I work, and my company, Present Tense, are based in the shop, in the front shop. And in the back, we have where we are right now, is a sort of kind of communal living area that is often inhabited by different artists and musicians. And the kitchen bench, which like we can see right now, is actually where we worked for almost a year on the Margaret Fulton musical.
Oh.
So Amy LaPalma spent a year on that bench, like literally standing on that bench.
Oh, that's fantastic. And of course, we were meant to be in the studio today, but we have been supplanted by a number of boxes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's more comfortable here, though.
But it means that we have the opportunity to sit in the living room on these fantastic old cinema chairs.
From the Astor.
Oh, they're from the Astor.
Oh, really?
Fantastic.
I stole them one day. I just...
Okay. Not on air, Bryce. Yeah, not on air. Yeah. Okay, now
you were quiet.
To get us started, we'll get you to read your story for us, Bryce.
I'm really nervous about reading the story, I have to say. I was born in Wenderee, and Wenderee is a bland Ballarat suburb that emerged in the 1950s and is defined by a pokies venue and a shopping centre. Some people never leave Wenderee, not even to travel 6 kilometres to Ballarat. My mum and dad, Vicky and Ian, are experts at love and affirmation. Today they're my biggest supporters, but back then they felt challenged when at 6 years of age, I declared I was not interested in the normal Wenderee things, soccer, football or basketball. I have no idea how I knew about theatre. Our family had no connection to art or theatre, and the music we listened to was restricted to the bagpipes and the Beatles, which are the two things that my dad loves most in the world. But somehow I knew about theatre, and I had that theatre bug before I stepped into a theatre. I became the child in the local adult theatre productions. It was affirming because theatre is one of the few places in a society where children and adults are on even footing. Expectations are equal. When you're a child in the theatre, you're expected to work as hard as the adults, and there's no dumbing down the activity and no lowering of expectations. So theatre inadvertently taught me about the importance of being proud, finding your voice, and not dumbing down anything for anyone, ever. I found theatre empowering and it transformed me. It was theatre and music that first captured my imagination and performance that forced me to become an active contributor, a collaborator and a leader focused on change. My journey starts in Wenderee and it's progressed around the world. Now to Yarraville. I've spoken at the United Nations. I've reshaped how the ABC engages with young people in rural and regional Australia. I was the first general manager of Sin Youth Media, one of Australia's largest youth organisations. I've composed contemporary operas and I even co-created an award-winning musical about Margaret Fulton. Legend. My resume would read very differently if I hadn't stumbled into the theatre. Today, as Artistic Director of Present Tense and as a lecturer at the VCA and at the Arts Academy at Fed Uni in Ballarat, my own theatre practice is defined by my struggle towards a new voice, a new composed theatre, one that defies the known paradigms, breaking form, genre and ties with traditional music, theatre and opera. So I hope I stand on the shoulders of Heiner Goebbels and Philip Glass, Leonard Bernstein and Steve Reich. And I'm just adding this into the story right now. I'm coining the term epic minimalism. That's what I'm interested in. This new music theatre ruptures the culturally guilty 19th century. It questions the state imagery of the orchestra and, of course, the youth yearning musical, national nostalgic opera houses, and instead I created gymnasium to listen and experience how it feels, how you feel and how the universe feels. And outside of theatre, I believe just fundamentally in creating change. Underpinning my commitment to change is a belief in the power of storytelling and how storytelling transforms individuals, organisations and communities. So through my work, I strive to unleash the creative potential of my collaborators, the artists who enable my work, the organisations I embed my work within, and the communities that I work alongside. I reckon that an artist is an agent of change. These days, I regularly work with young people as well. This generation of young Australians might eradicate global poverty and perhaps tackle climate change to slow down its devastating effects. So in short, we need young people and communities to thrive. My work is complex and complicated. Full stop.
Woo!
Thank you, Bryce. You're right. There's so much to cover here. There's so many nuggets throughout that story that we're going to talk about over the next hour or so. But I want to go back and start in Windaree, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
You described it as a bland Ballarat suburb, which sounds quite different, to be honest, to the life that you're living right now in Yarraville, I imagine. How do you think that Windaree shaped your voice as a storyteller all those years ago?
Well, I think that I'm an expert in what rural and regional poverty is. And like Windaree is a bland place, but also it's a very difficult place because it's on the fringes of a community. And when you come from the fringes, when you come from the margins, and I particularly think about my mum's family, who are part of what I would say is systemic under or unemployment in Australia that exists on the outskirts of cities and communities. Look, you start to understand the complexity of modern Australia, of contemporary Australia. And so, in a way, like a lot of my work has been about enabling my own voice, enabling the voices of others. And, I mean, so what that means is that there's always an element of social justice to everything that I do, that I'm, like, always breaking the rules, because to escape somewhere like Windaree, you have to break the rules. Mm. And I guess that I'm also questioning every form of structure, because in a way, Ballarat has some of the richest people in Australia and also some of the poorest people in Australia. And certainly my mum's family would constitute some of the poorest people in Australia. And that duality for me is where, really, where we need to start questioning what are Australian values. And you know, if we have a sense of a shared future, how do we reconcile, for instance, young people who are growing up who are told to aspire to nothing? And that is what it's like on the fringes of a community. So I guess at Windaree, I carry it with me everywhere I go. And it's a badge of honour. And it's also, in a way, a fuck you to a lot of people. And I think that for a lot of us who come from those sorts of places, it is the motivation to continue through everything, because, you know, in a way, we have no other choice.
Like, yeah, I find it really interesting. I've met you a couple of times briefly before this interview today, Bryce. And when I first met you, it immediately struck me that you have very strong grounded opinions and beliefs in and what you're doing. And they come from a really fixed centre in you. And it sounds like it's this idea of what you know about yourself as a human being before you learn anything else. Hmm. And you mention in your story that you had the theatre bug before you stepped into a theatre. And it's, again, this idea that your body knows something before your intellect does. And it's an idea that's often ignored in our society, this idea of understanding things on an intrinsic level. Yeah. Can you talk to us about, I don't know if you remember your very first experience in theatre or the first moment that you stepped onto stage as a storyteller?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it was around the age of 6 or 7. And it was in Creswick, which is about 10 minutes outside of Ballarat.
Good old Creswick.
In the Creswick Town Hall. And there was a youth theatre company there with a couple of senior citizens who were quite brilliant, because they were composing and writing their own musicals every year for children. And hundreds of Ballarat children went through this local theatre company. And I love it still, because in a way it's different to a lot of youth theatre, which seems to be Bugsy Malone and, you know, Annie and all of that stuff. Instead, these were sort of these original musical theatre works. So I always wonder about how much that shaped me, because that's something which I continue to work on now. But I think I knew by the age of 10 that I wasn't a performer, because I was so fascinated in what everybody else was doing.
Yeah.
You know, I was observing the director. I was questioning the decisions designers were making on works, you know, even at that age. And a great set designer who, you know, encountered me at that time said to me years later, like, sort of all the children who went through theatre, you were the only one who was standing on stage drawing out designs and also giving notes to a designer. Apparently I told him, you know, that in fact that entrance was not going to work, and I was right.
Which designers love at the first.
Yeah, episode. It's definitely the way to endear yourself to someone. Yeah,
that's right. Look, I agree with you. We intrinsically feel things, and I feel like a lot of the time when you teach and you work with young people, actually your job is to say that gut instinct, that thing you have inside you, which is tied to ancient human experience alongside the experience of the values that underpin who you are and where you come from and your connection to the landscape around you and the world around you, though that knowledge is actually important. And it's like we spend a lot of time just coming back to the things that are intrinsically who we are. So if you think about theatre training, for instance, actually it's about a connection to breath, feet connected to the ground, trusting your instinct, backing yourself, like really basic things that we spend almost a lifetime having to relearn.
I think the other point I wanted to cover here, and Lauren, you started to delve into this a little bit, was around this idea of being able to trust yourself and that you really centered in your ideas. And we spoke briefly about your parents being experts at love and affirmation. Do you feel like this idea of unconditional love that you got from your parents helped to develop that sense of who you are?
Look, I think so, because I work with and against that all the time. I work with and against their unconditional love and support. And I guess that a few people could claim this, but I grew up with my parents and my parents grew up with me. So in other words, like, they both didn't graduate from high school. You know, they were both working class Ballarat. And through their children, through me and my sister, their perspectives on the world have radically altered. So you could say in a way that when I was born, they were conservative country working class, like a lot of Australians. And, you know, at the last election, my dad voted Green. And, you know, I mean, they have their own version of social justice now and who they are and, you know, their connection to the things they see. And, like, in a way, like, it's like through their children, they have grown up and experienced the world in ways that few people could claim about their parents. And so, like, that motivates me as well, because I guess what it tells me is that everybody is capable of change, you know, and my parents look at some of their friends from Ballarat now who they would tell you are racist, or they would tell you have very narrow perspectives on climate change or, you know, gay marriage or whatever. They will also tell you it's because they know no better. And this thing about when you widen someone's perspective, and that's not telling someone what to believe.
It's going on a journey. Yeah, it's connecting to them through the human experience and discovering things about themselves along the way.
Yeah. My folks did that. And so that, you know, it's great. And that, I mean, and also, like, they also don't care as well in equal measure. They love and they don't care in equal measure, which is so wonderful.
Before we leave your theatre experiences in Ballarat, and you were obviously an active member of the community from a young age, as we've discussed, and this idea of community and family extends throughout your career. You were, of course, awarded the Australian Young Citizen of the Year Award in Ballarat in 2002.
How did you know that?
Well, we know everything.
Just a small golf clap there for you.
Which is a huge honour, particularly because you had become aware of this idea of observing other people and wanting to be more than just one actor piece of the puzzle. What did it mean to you at the time, and how do you think that influenced your career progression?
Look, I think that giving a young person an award or an accolade at that point enables them to do more. So, like, when I do work with young people, in a way, I'm trying to help frame for them the possibilities and the possibilities of what they might do. And I don't care if it's theatre or if it's radio or if it's television. Like, what I care about really is that it involves leadership, it involves change, and it involves getting proud in your own skin. And so I think for me, like, that just added legitimacy to all the things that I was fighting for. And it also meant that for a little while I had some currency, and actually I used that currency wisely. You know, I helped champion things that I believed in. Particularly at that point, I was just becoming the manager of SYN.
Yeah,
which was the youth media organisation. And that kind of thing helps you meet with philanthropic organisations. It helps you seem like a trusted...
Did you say seem like a trusted?
Yeah, seem like a trusted set of pair of hands. You know? I'm just trying to think about how to word it. But, you know, it means that, in a way, people, you've been verified a little bit. And it's interesting because that verification, just thinking about the Melbourne Fringe Awards on Saturday, that verification does mean a lot for people at that point of their careers. Like when you're emerging or you're young or you're doing something new, just having that, yes, this is now someone to watch, is really crucial. It's why we need these ecologies.
Yeah.
And you did speak a little bit about your role at SYN as general manager. For people who don't know, obviously, SYN is a youth-focused media organisation that believes young people should be creators and not consumers of media. And its flagship is obviously the radio station. Now, you followed that work up with being the director of Community Broadcasting Association of Australia. So you've really moved into broadcasting at this point after, I imagine, that you've left Ballarat and this point you've come to Melbourne. What prompted the progression into looking more at broadcasting and I guess that progression in your career?
A whole series of accidents and glorious accidents, really. Yeah. SYN was awarded a community radio license in 2001, and it was one of the last major community radio licenses to be awarded in Australia. And it was the idea of SYN, Student Youth Network, a group of students and a group of young people powering a radio station, was in fact a radical idea in 2001, 2002. And just before we see the rise of what was called Web 2.0, the Facebooks and the YouTubes and the Twitters and that sort of thing, what I knew for sure was that young people were locked out of democracy and that young people were locked out of conversations that mattered in the media. And I was sick of the way that young people were portrayed in mainstream media, and something needed to be done to address that. Now, what SYN knew was that it got a license and it needed to organise itself. And I was watching SYN from afar in that first, you know, its first year of setting itself up, and just decided to make the strategic decision to drop out of a Bachelor of Arts and commit my work to, you know, enabling SYN and getting SYN into a point where it would be powerful. And I became the first general manager. SYN had had station managers for years and years and years as a student union organisation, but it was now an incorporated association. And what I could see was that it had a mandate to become a platform for all young Australians to express themselves. And so really, that was what I spent my time working on as a manager, making sure that SYN thought of itself beyond RMIT University and beyond the secondary schools that were involved, and instead thought about what do young Australians need and how can young Australians express themselves through this platform. So, you know, 15 years later, SYN is really the success story of independent and community media in Australia. Its alumni reads as the who's who of the Australian media industries. And that stuff really interests me. But, of course, the thing that I care about most is that I believe that SYN has saved people's lives. I think that, you know, there are young people who came through SYN who would be doing very different things, would be unwell if they had not had that experience. And that's because SYN, I guess like what I said about youth theatre in the beginning, demands that all of the young people involved share their voices authentically, and you are on even footing with everything else around you in the media landscape. And so, yeah, it was a detour. I was making theatre, and this was a detour, but, you know, if I'd had my time again, of course I would do the detour again, because it was a chance to do something major. And when we see those moments, we have to seize them. And, you know, I'm so glad that I did.
And it's interesting you talk about, you know, an organisation saving people's lives and giving people a voice. Because in 2002, you began working with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Now, you've worked with them in many forms up until today, I believe. But originally you were an executive producer, and you later had a role as chief facilitator of the Haywire Summit.
Yeah.
Now, for those that aren't aware, Haywire is a competition, and it's a summit run by the ABC that has been giving regional Australians an opportunity to get their voice heard on big issues and make a difference since 1998. As a young regional Aussie myself, so I'm from a little country town called Kundrook, a town of about 650, and I really remember around about that time growing up, and that regional issues, you started to get really pissed off as a young regional kid, because you'd hear a lot about state issues and national issues, but regional issues weren't really being paid attention to. And I just remember Haywire is such a fantastic way and pretty much a catalyst for a lot of my friends and peers starting to understand that as a country kid, you could have a voice and you could make a difference. And so I had friends enter and be involved, and it was such a fantastic initiative back then. And it was pre what you called Web 2.0 as well. So there was this whole sense of it was very pertinent, and it was an amazing way to get the message out there. So I guess the back end of this is, can you tell us a bit more about the impact of Haywire and what it taught you? And I imagine it came from a pretty personal place, being a regional kid yourself.
Look, it was a really fascinating opportunity because I, you know, by the time I was 23, I had been the manager of SIM for almost 5 years. And to be a young general manager is quite an extraordinary experience. And I was ready for another challenge, and this came up. Really, the ABC was beginning to experience the disruptive media environment. You could feel the rumblings underneath the surface in regards to what is going to happen to newspapers and radio and television. And so, in quite an inspired sort of moment of leadership, Mark Scott, the managing director, said, we have to start experimenting, and we have to start employing people who have very different skill sets to our current staff. And I was one of those people. And my job was really to use Haywire as a hothouse for trying ideas.
Wow.
And so, you know,
An awesome opportunity.
Yeah, amazing.
It was great. Amazing. And so we were experimenting with blogs and with Twitter and Facebook and online stories. And in a way, we reinvented what was an essay writing competition. It was you'd write an essay and you would win.
Yep.
And it's now like really a significant platform, probably the ABC's, one of the ABC's largest community engagement projects. It's, you know, been celebrated by government and by philanthropic organisations and community groups for its impact. And its impact begins with telling a story. A young person tells a story about themselves or their community or their aspirations or the things they care about. And then 40 of those stories get selected and get produced with the ABC. And what's brilliant is the ABC really doesn't edit those stories. They work with the young people to help frame and tell them. And then those young people come to Canberra and they help create ideas that will result in significant change in regional and rural Australia. So in other words, like, they get given tools and how to be a change maker. And that summit has resulted in projects of such significance, you know, from, you know, a couple of young women up in Queensland who are going out to schools every week to talk about racism and their experiences of racism. And, you know, again, that starts with storytelling, but actually this has become a major project in Queensland involving lots of young people to... I just saw on the weekend, like, one of my personal favourites, The Race, which is up in Darwin right now, which is a race around Darwin to visit every multicultural and ethnic group in Darwin. you know, and it's kind of like an amazing race type experience.
Yeah.
To Boots for Change, which is a group of young ag science students and farming students who are encouraging communities and individuals to wear their boots to the farmers' markets and have conversations about where produce is coming from and, you know, how you can ensure ethical farming in Australia and how we can better empower our farmers. So, I mean, all of those ideas are the results of young people telling their stories and going through that Haywire process. And so, I mean, again, what's interesting now is, like, I've been involved in Haywire for over a decade. And I'm still not old, which is great. You know, I mean, I'm old by Haywire standards, but I'm not by ABC standards.
And
I think the other thing I learned through that process is there are lots of fads in regards to online storytelling, community engagement. But really, when you know what your values are, Nick, you were talking about it. Now, what doesn't change in Australia? If you are a young person, you are locked out of many conversations that matter, and you are constantly told that you are tomorrow's leader. I don't believe that. Like, you are today's leader because you're here now. But, you know, that's the experience of being a young person. if you come from a regional and rural place, you are doubly disenfranchised. And also, let's like work this out as well. If you come from a regional and rural place, it's more likely you might be, for instance, an Indigenous young person, or a young person with a disability, or a young person who is struggling with their sexuality, because even though we've jumped leaps and bounds in the last decade, it's difficult coming out in regional and rural Australia. And so, you know, in a way, the core of the Haywire Project doesn't ever change. And because of that grounding, the work does extraordinary things. And yeah, I'm very privileged to be part of it.
While we're on this theme of being a voice to create change, you mentioned you snuck very briefly into your story that you had the experience of speaking at the United Nations. Can we talk in more detail about that?
Oh, look, you know, I mean... So
I'm assuming you didn't just crash a UN conference that you were invited and...
No crashing a UN conference. But, you know, really, again, it was connecting all of this work up. And I guess that, you know, the thing about the United Nations for me is that in Australia, we don't think about that global community nearly enough. I mean, that's part of the tyranny of distance. But really... That experiment of the United Nations is one of the greatest achievements of modern humanity. And when it works intrinsically well. And young people are always invited to be part of the United Nations. It's one of the things that they have continuously advocated for. So regularly people speak about, you know, the experience of young people from around the world. And I guess my interest really is how do we enable more young people to be change makers. And so that was what I was talking about in connecting with the work of SIN. I've put forward actually a new project for young people. I mean, at the moment, without wanting to go too much into it, trying to develop an idea that would involve young people from around the world, each working on a project of significant change in their communities, but connecting those projects through storytelling. I mean, in a way, like the invitation came from already knocking on a lot of doors. So, you know, a couple of years ago, I experienced the death of a really close friend, and her death really, for me, just provided, the final bit of resolve that I needed for just, like, not being afraid to knock on doors and not being afraid to rattle the cages. And so, yeah, you know, go for it and then you get opportunities to do amazing things.
So we look, Nick, at some of the amazing things that Bryce has been up to.
Well, definitely. I think the first thing that I want to start to cover is looking at the amazing things that you do with another collaborator that you work with. So a gentleman named Nate Jilks was soon to become the co-founder and artistic director of Present Tense Theatre alongside you. This was kind of the next step in your journey, I guess, wasn't it? You were at the VCA at the time, I believe, and that's where you met Nate?
Yeah, so... You know, in 2010, I'd been working as an executive, a manager, and a leader in media organisations for a long time, and I was still under the age of 30. I had an office in the South Bank building of the ABC that looked out over the Victorian College of the Arts, which is across the road.
Mm.
And I think it's fair to say I'd not made much theatre in that time. Like, I'd directed and created a few works over that kind of 8 to 9 years, but mostly I'd spent my time working in and with media, radio, television, and online. And I was seeing the works of artists like Tanya Gerstel and Jenny Kemp, Lisa Shelton, and others who were all connected with the Victorian College of the Arts. And particularly Tanya Gerstel and Jenny Kemp's work was just... you know, I would come away and not be able to sleep after seeing, you know, their works. Tanya's work is exceptionally embodied physical theatre, wows you in its use of space, in the poetics of the body in space, and, you know, like you sort of come away from it feeling like you've been punched in the face and you've been lifted into the air at once. That's what it achieves. And so I realised that, in fact, coming right back, that bug was still within me and I needed to make a shift because otherwise I was just going to become another mediocre ABC manager. and so had this moment of truth. I went across to the VCA and ran into Richard Murfitt and said, look, I don't have an undergraduate degree and, you know, I don't actually really have that much experience in theatre, but I think I'd be really good in your postgrad program. And Richard took one look at me and he's like, are you Bryce Ives from Sin? And I was like, yeah, he's coming to my office. And so what was amazing was that all of my experience, you know, from Sin and from the ABC, from working with young people, was, again, currency, the legitimacy to then enter into an institution and study. And it was a transformative experience. During that time, I started working with Nate Gilles. And we made a project where we started composing music together and composing music for a really what was an installation work. And it was probably the first time in my career where I was like, this is everything. Yeah, this is what I'm really interested in storytelling. It was extreme darkness in the work. There was a lot of listening for a long time for the audience. And it was a cathartic and emotional experience where, like, what I hope we achieve with our work is that you can't actually put it into words, which, of course, means it's very difficult to write reviews or grant applications. But we found a way of working, which I guess in arts thinking you call a practice. And we've been in practice, you know, ever since. So that's now, we've been collaborating for six years. And that's a very large and ongoing body of work that doesn't really stop. And it's in some ways unrelenting in practice. So, you know, people describe our work as music theatre or as opera or as sometimes site-specific theatre or installations. Very difficult to categorise what we do, which is, you know, in a way, when you think about Heiner Goebbels, he's in a very similar boat. Is that music theatre or what is that? But we, you know, the easiest way I describe it is we sit at the intersection of music, theatre and opera, and we're interested in experiences that fundamentally rock. I mean, when we say that, people realise that we're not talking about Oklahoma or Motherwell at that point.
And in the 6 years of present tense, the Margaret Fulton Queen of the Dessert, where does that fit into? Was that one of your first shows? Or
Look, that was 2012. So, yeah, that was one of our first shows. I mean, in some ways, it's our most popular work and people continue to love, you know, particularly the moment that involved the pressure cooker.
So, of course, this was adapted from the book I Sang for My Supper by Margaret herself, who I understand is a wonderful personality. Is that a good way to describe her? And it does, I mean, you talk about wanting to create change and have new forms of theatre and how difficult it is to pinpoint exactly the work that you guys are producing. But the themes of this show are very interesting but also sound really powerful, and they examine the growth of modern Australia from a time gone by through food.
Yes.
And they also acknowledge some of the challenges that we face as a nation, particularly for women. And can you talk about the decision to create this show?
Well, we can't take credit for creating the show.
Choosing to put it on stage.
We worked alongside two other writers, which was Doug McLeod and Yuri Warrenshuk. And it was an exceptionally interesting collaboration because they are both really old school comedy and TV writers and composers and have exceptional chops in that space. You know, like, I mean, Doug and Yuri were like the Comedy Company and Fast Forward and all of that stuff that Nate and I had grown up watching on television. I mean, like all Australians. And so this combination between this kind of radical new young music theatre makers and these guys who really know how to tell jokes and really a part of, if you like, an Australian voice. Like, if you look at Doug's writing, like, really, Kath and Kim, Sea Change, I mean, it's intrinsically part of Australian culture. And so that team working with Margaret Fulton was just one of those, you know, aha moments, because it was a coming together of ancient knowledge in comedy and in cooking and in life with a youthful energy. And so it was a rock and roll comedy theatre food experience. And, you know, and Nate and I, it's not exactly the type of work we want to make again and again and again, but within the work, within the music arrangements, for instance, we were paying homage to John Farnham. And the arrangement sounded like the John Farnham band. And there's probably the song that everybody remembers from that musical is the song about Margaret, the book. It was livened up the nation and taught her how to cook with a little inspiration and the Margaret Fulton book. And then you've got to just imagine that, like with a kind of seven voice arrangement, aka what Farnham would do.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like when in doubt, what would John Farnham do? You know, like he would just be going off and the drums and that.
The passion is still there for this show for you, isn't it?
Yeah, the passion is still there. But, of course, I mean, where it flips everything around is the fact that it's a story about an Australian woman who is under-celebrated and misunderstood. You know, so Margaret is now remembered as the little woman in the kitchen, and the little woman in the kitchen has connotations about the 50s. And Margaret Fulton was not about that stuff. Margaret changed the way that Australians eat. She turned around to mainstream Australia and she said, look at who's arriving. At first it was the Greeks and the Italians, and then it was the Vietnamese. And Margaret was saying, we can learn to cook from these people. And it's true that before Margaret Fulton, a Sunday roast was different shades of grey. You know, like that is what Australians knew how to do. And you consider how we eat as modern Australians, and that is Margaret Fulton. And so, that was one of the reasons why we wanted to tell the story. But also, it asks serious questions of what is feminism, because Margaret herself, of course, rejected the idea of feminism in the 60s because she was a business person and she was getting on with the job. Now, in retrospect, that, of course, is feminism as well, and that complex thing where Ita Buttrose and Margaret Fulton are breaking down the glass ceiling whilst Germaine is writing essays and speaking so eloquently, and both of those things matter. One doesn't stand above the other one. That Margaret Fulton stood up to the men around her and she told them what for. You know, she told Rupert Murdoch what for a number of times in her career, and she owned significant gravitas in the business world way before even Ita. And so, you know, I think that all of that stuff made for a compelling story. And look, I mean, without going too far into it, it's so challenging to tell the story of someone who's alive and someone who is loved and also someone who is so well known for calling it like it is. We were petrified probably 2 weeks out because there were things about Margaret's story that she didn't want to include in the show. And at the very last minute, I included some of that stuff because I was really afraid that she sounded a bit too much like Mary Poppins and we needed to believe what would happen. And so I sat nervously there in the theatre on the opening night because Margaret was sitting in the front row with, you know, only like 25 of her closest friends and family. And there was a moment sort of 10 minutes in when I realised we were going to be okay, because the second song in the show, which I really pushed hard for, was a song that was inspired by a conversation with Margaret where she said she's over being Margaret Fulton. She said she's over everything. She's over the celebrity endorsements. She's over, you know, having to turn up at events. She's over, and she said the words, I'm over being a national living treasure. And I was like, that's brilliant. That's got to be the song, second song in the show. In an American musical, that would be the I Want song. I want to change the world. I'm going to teach Australians how to cook. I'm going to introduce eggplant. I am going to change Australia. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to change Australia. Here's my quest. Here we are. In the Margaret Fulton musical, instead we started with I'm over everything. I'm over all of you guys, and I'm over being a national living treasure. I'm over Woolworths. I'm over MasterChef. I'm over the whole bloody lot, and I'm going home. And, of course, at that moment, when Amy LaPalma sang that as Margaret, there was one person who just started clapping, and it was Margaret Fulton, and she stood up and gave herself a standing ovation, you know? And at that point, I was like, oh, we're okay. Margaret's on board.
There, she's on board. Okay. That's great.
And, you know, at the end of the show that night, because the stuff that I included in that work was quite emotional, like really about love and loss, which she didn't want to go into, but we did. And at the end of the show, I walked up to her and, you know, the tears coming down. You're just thinking she's 90 and she's watching mostly people under the age of 30, other than Doug and Yuri, watching them celebrate her life's work and also going into parts of her life that were exceptionally personal. Like, you know, she had a number of failed relationships with men and she was a single mum in the 60s, you know, and was trying to do that alongside all of her business interests. And so, you know, she just came up to me and she said, you know, this is a gift. I'm ready to go now. This is a gift.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was like, you know, everything else can sort of go to the side in a way.
Yeah, I think this is a really important idea here. And you just talking about what you decided to tackle in the show and what to keep in. Yeah. And in your story earlier, you mentioned that through Wurundjeri Community Theatre back in the day came at the idea of equal expectations for adults and children and you learning to not dumb things down for anyone ever.
Yes.
Do you feel that through the work that you're able to do with Present Tense, through shows like this, you've had this opportunity to perpetuate this sense of equality and not dumbing things down?
That's what we attempt to do. And if you actually look at our body of work, it's so fascinating because no two works are ever the same. You know, like our Chance de Catacombe, which is an immersive theatre experience of huge size and scale, epic from beginning to end. And Margaret Fulton, Queen of the Dessert, like what do those two things have in common? And actually there is stuff that's underneath about the stories that we don't tell, about the voices that we don't include in structure and power, or also that how it feels experience. You know, in the Margaret Fulton work, that ecstatic rock was also alluding to something else that was happening at the time. And so, look, yeah, we strive for that in all of our works. And I guess in a way that's why we don't, you know, that's why we say no to directing Stephen Sondheim. And that's why, you know, and why we say no to established plays and established musicals, because instead we're fighting for something else.
Do you feel within that though that things like Sondheim's, you know, does everything have its place?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I mean, in a way, like the writers I admire Stephen Sondheim a lot, and Bernstein in particular. Like Bernstein for me is, if we could aspire for anything in our own practice, Bernstein would be the closest artist I could relate to. I mean, from conductor to director to writer, composer, educator, and someone who, you know, fundamentally changed how Americans perceive themselves and the stories that Americans were telling. And, you know, we don't think about it now, but if you think about West Side Story for a second, that infusion of jazz with, like, minimalist music, with classic sound, nobody had ever done anything like that before. And that's contemporary America for you. That's the America that Bernstein knew. And I mean, and of course, now we have parodies of the song America, you know, from West Side, because it's so part of culture. But actually, that was also a radical act at the time, you know, to have a group of, you know, people, Latinos, singing, I want to be in America, you know, I'm going to be free in America. You know, that was a big moment. I think people like Bernstein, I aspire to be like. I don't want to ever stage any of their works, and I'd be happy to never see a Bernstein work again in my life. But like from an artist and a practice perspective, mm-hmm. My God, like, yes, of course. And sometimes you put in the same Vogue, that ability to tell a story and to surprise and shock you. I still love that.
I really love hearing you talk about your work because it's very evident how passionate you are about your work and how much you invest in it. And out of your story too, there was some wonderful self-analysis around pride in your work and being a leader of change. How important is it to have the pride in your work? Do you feel like that is everything in regards to what you deliver? Like you have to be proud of that work or else why the bloody hell am I doing it?
Well, look, I mean, yeah. My time in Melbourne really is defined by a number of relationships as well. And probably the most important relationships to me are two of my closest friends, Adam Smith, who is an amazing thinker, probably one of Australia's leading thinkers in regards to education and young people. And he was the leader of the Foundation for Young Australians for a long time. And involved in the International Youth Foundation and currently doing amazing work with laureate universities really across the whole world. And, yeah, that's connected with the Clinton family and all of that stuff.
Wow.
But Adam and Stella Young, the disability activist and advocate, like we had a relationship over 15 years. We all arrived in Australia, we all arrived in Melbourne at the same time as young people from regional places, ready to change the world. And of course, if you're ready to change the world, it means you'll fail a number of times. And I've failed a whole lot of times, more than most people. And I guess that when I look back now, what we were really doing was teaching each other how to get proud. And Stella had this knowledge from the disability community, this gorgeous poem by a poet called Laura Harling. And it's a, if you have a disability, you would know this poem. It's called You Get Proud by Practicing. And in the poem, we're told that it's not going to be a doctor or a social worker or politicians or business leaders that will teach you to get proud. You know, it's not going to be your parents or your teachers or the man down the street. Like, the only way you get proud is by practicing. I mean, for people who have lived on the margins, like, you know that more than anybody else. But I guess that I think about pride and I think about getting proud, and I think that those two, Adam and Stella, taught me more about that than anybody else. And, you know, this is really why friendship and love is important. And maybe that, what you're talking about, is embodied within all of my work. Like, I mean, and particularly the Margaret Fulton work, really, that's at the core of it as well. It's always there somewhere in it. That what we could call glorious little gifts, the like the generosity of human beings from one another. And that, you know, love really enables us to do amazing things. And those amazing things have impact. And storytelling is really at the core of all of that. It's very difficult to tell stories when you don't feel joy or love.
So you've worked in so many areas as a storyteller, performer, producer, broadcaster, facilitator, director, teacher, theatre maker. I'm sure there's more. There's probably more.
Troublemaker. I'm very big in Yarraville as well.
The shit stirrer of Yarraville. Yeah. Currently on LinkedIn, your role is listed as changemaker, designer, and facilitator.
Yeah.
And on Pinterest, you're a theatre director, maker of media, advocate. I nearly said avocado. Advocate and activist, artistic director of Present Tense Theatre, and coffee drinker.
Yeah.
As a freelancer. And I think many of our listeners will resonate for them. With many talents comes the confusion of how you identify yourself, yes, whether that be to prospective employers or to fellow storytellers and artists. How do you personally navigate communicating your skill set?
Well, look, I mean, I think we need to take that one step further and go, we have an issue with complexity in Australia. And within the arts, we have, and you think about the arts as being a place that celebrates, if you like, big ideas and multi-layered thinking. Yet we want to box people in and we want to do it really quickly. And I can't begin to tell you how many times I've had well-meaning advisors tell me that I need to distill down my practice or I need to reshape how I communicate about myself or... you know, I need to own one space. And I reject that. I follow my energy all of the time. And, yeah, it means it's really difficult to describe what I do, but I make no apologies for that because the impact is what matters. I don't really care if you can't describe in a sentence what it is I do. We're complex people. I mean, I think about how I love, I think about how I live, and I can't describe that stuff in a sentence. And both of those things are tied to my work. It's all the same. Work and love and life are the same things for me in everything that I do. And so, you know, it doesn't warrant a one-sentence answer.
Well, actually, I think two words you used at the top of the interview, might fit this very nicely in that idea of epic minimalism, which is such such a paradox in itself.
I mean, I just, from a freelance perspective, we struggle because we have grant bodies and media organisations and artistic leaders who want simple and quick answers. They don't exist. They're not interesting. If you get to the answer too soon, you're answering the wrong question. And we should be more unapologetic about just saying, well, actually, this is my body of work. And it involves everything from musical theatre to site-specific immersive experiences to community work and everything in between. And in fact, you know, it's the sum of all of this work that allows me to create beautifully intricate moments of facilitation and experience.
Beautiful. I want to move thoughts slightly now to the Australian climate for the arts industry, if you will, for lack of a better term.
Oh, good.
you're like, I've been waiting.
Yeah, here we go. We're on. So first of all, let's just jump right into it. As far as storytellers, what are some of the biggest challenges that Australian storytellers are facing at the moment?
That we still haven't accepted our own history. And so I come from Ballarat, and Ballarat is the Dubai of its day. You know, it pops up overnight, and it's a bunch of really super rich white people who have become super rich very quickly trying to rebuild Glasgow or Amsterdam in Western Victoria. And that means that Ballarat is a very interesting place to tell stories, because within it you have mythology, you have struggle, you have the need to try and express a new identity and a new way of thinking. And you also have ancient knowledge in Indigenous people. The term Ballarat, you know, is older than the pyramids. Ballarat has been a resting place. That Ballarat means resting place. It's meant that for a long time, long before, you know, Shakespeare. So that makes it, for me, a fascinating place to ask questions about identity, because I also don't want to demonize or misunderstand the struggle of those Irish and Scottish and European miners and settlers who were really looking for a better life themselves. But equally, I can't pretend that Ballarat wasn't very quickly living in a revisionist history state where, you know, within 10 years of popping up, Ballarat was calling itself old Ballarat, historic Ballarat, which goes through to this day where, like, its biggest industry is Sovereign Hill. So, in other words, when you think about Australia, really fascinating to actually deal with that information. And so I think I'm frustrated that we spend a long time on, for me, fringe issues. Like, if I think about, like, for instance, gender and queer theatre, which I think is important and needs a voice, but it seems like we're spending a long time on, like, what is a male and what is a female and what is fluidity and gender, and we're not really dealing with the politics of the landscape around us and the struggle of people around us to try and make sense of this place. And I feel like when we do that, we will become much more significant in global theatre practice and in global storytelling. And when we continue to tinker around the edges and not go to the core of that question, like, really, we're just another sort of place producing a range of okay stories. Does that make sense?
Totally.
And in terms of struggle and making sense of this place, in the next, I don't know, 6 to 12 months, what struggles do you think you might be looking at as a storyteller or being trying to make sense of?
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, look, I mean, I'm feeling motivated by what I said in the story at the beginning, that for this generation of young people, it's the first generation ever that could be involved in ending global poverty as we know it, eradicating global poverty. And so for me, that's one of the biggest questions that I'm dealing with right now in my own work. Like, I'm almost going through a process of repurposing my own work again. I seem to do it every 5 or so years. But I'm fascinated by the lack of discourse around that in Australia. Because if you are interested, for instance, in advancing women in leadership positions, you need to eradicate global poverty. You know, if you want to end climate change, you have to eradicate global poverty, whatever issue you're interested
and,
in.
Yeah, they're inextricably linked. I mean, I do think it's important. I was reading a media release recently from the CEO of Oxfam, and since the 90s, I hope I've got this right, but since the 90s, we've actually halved global poverty.
Yeah.
And I think it's really easy to become lost in this idea that terrible things are happening in the world, but that things are getting worse. You know, it's important to remember that we are able to make change, to make positive change, and to focus on things that indicate that maybe we are headed in the right direction on some fronts.
Well, I mean,
obviously more is needed.
We have the potential, the millennials have the potential to see the end of global poverty. Now, that has never been an imaginable idea in human history. And at the same time, these are the dying moments to do anything meaningful to slow down climate change. And, you know, that makes this moment in time so fascinating to be alive. And, yeah, look, you know, you could feel depressed about the world. I mean, I guess that in a way, I've got a different perspective on this because, you know, I feel like if I could, I love many things to do with the ABC, but one of the things that I don't love is ABC News 24. And I say this, and I have a lot of friends who work for ABC News 24. I've just publicly declared that. But I don't love ABC News 24 because for me it's part of the ongoing cycle of crap that we don't need in our day-to-day lives. Like, we don't need to know what is happening in Parliament House right now at this very moment in time. We don't need to know if the Prime Minister looked a little bit angry this morning when he walked out of the meeting with the Treasurer. And we don't need to know that the Treasurer wore a red tie and not a blue tie today. You know, all of this stuff is part of the dumbing down of thinking. And so, like, we actually need deep analysis and perspectives that are considered. That's what art making does when it's at its absolute best. We have a lot of, for instance, bloggers, opinion writers, people on Twitter who are just part of that problem right now. You know, like, you see something and you have an immediate response and you tweet it and you think that's great. I've called that person out on whatever it is they've said or they've done. That's not considered and it's not changing anything. And so, like, when we think about this time and I think about storytelling, actually, yeah, we can feel really depressed about the world because we are, it's like we're in a cycle that just keeps on going on now, which and is powering itself. And it makes us feel like we're doing something and we're not, you know. And I feel like, in a way, the arts community has to reject this even more and more. If you're actually interested in news and current affairs, stop watching 24-hour news. Stop being on Twitter all day. Start writing essays.
Yeah.
You know, start making works that are considered and have deeper thought. Listen, breathe, stop. And, you know, in Australia, we need to reclaim it because, like, actually not very little interesting stuff happens on a day-to-day basis here. We don't warrant needing a 24-hour news channel. What requires reflection? Apartheid in Australia, you know, and that requires deep thinking. What requires reflection? What happened to Julia Gillard and the Australian public, and how the Australian public have now flipped their perspective on Julia Gillard.
Yeah.
You know, like, that requires analysis and deep thought, and you can't have that deep thought if you're just busy tweeting about what's happening at this immediate moment in time, because it feels relatively interesting and you feel relatively connected.
It's like we need to step back and take a look at the bigger picture and actually think about what we're contributing to.
Well, if you think about all the opinion writers in this country, they would talk about, you know, the essayists and writers that they admire who came from another generation who, when they sat down to write an essay, would spend time doing it. Now, look, there are two things happening here, like media organisations are asking ridiculous things of workers. You know, like, produce this by 4 o'clock this afternoon every day of the week. But we're also participating in it. We choose to participate in it.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, it, you know.
So on the back of that, you're with the young storytellers of today.
Yes.
what would be your advice to them on, like, just the next, the very next step in your storytelling journey to lead to more opportunity or more clarity on what it is they might want to achieve in their lives? What would be your advice on how to work out the next step?
Oh, that's a tough question.
I'm gonna rest. I'm gonna rest while you're thinking about this. have a little nap.
So the next step as a storyteller, and they are Australian, or are they?
Yeah. So young Australians.
Yeah.
We have access to so much information, but I don't think that necessarily helps.
Yeah. I would start with the premise that Australia is a glorious fucked up mess. And if Australia is a glorious fucked up mess, where do you fit into the mess? And where and what is your lineage in the mess? Where do you come from in that mess? And when you start to understand something about your lineage, you can then start to tell stories, I think. So that's where I would start. Well, what I would do is I would get a giant roll of paper and I would roll it out, and I would start on one side, the beginning of time, and on the other side I would write now, and I'd write a line down the middle, and I would literally and rigorously go through everything that allows you to tell stories that comes back through your lineage. So in other words, that goes way before the moment that you were born. And that's what I mean by that. So,
yeah, but it forms your identity.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in other words, like part of my lineage is the fact that, you know, my mum's family are sort of third generation Ballarat, and that, you know, they sort of came out as very, very poor Irish potato farmers. That informs how I tell stories. And likewise, my dad, you know, and their family came out in the 60s as part of the 10-pound Pommies. And so, and my dad had no perspective, for instance, on Indigenous Australia, because Indigenous Australia didn't exist in Ballarat in the 60s and 70s because my mum's family did such a great job eradicating Indigenous Australia and pushing them down, you know, beneath the surface. That all informs my lineage, if that makes sense. And, you know, when you can start to track out some of that stuff and understand how our perspectives are formed, then you can tell stories. And also that, like, what is the glorious mess or the fucked up glorious mess? Part of that for me is also acknowledging that, you know, I feel like Australia is in a position to turn its story around. And so from that perspective, you can then start to tell a story. But I'm also interested in how we connect with the world around us more. Like, I think about, for instance, for young people, at this point, there are now 2 billion, I think it's 2.5 billion people under the age of 20 in the world. There's never been this many teenagers into early 20s ever. And a lot of those young people I've worked with in Tanzania and through India are doing amazing things. And they're not waiting for other people to say, you have the authority to do this. They just are. I think sometimes when I look at young Australians, we're still waiting for government to do something. We're still waiting for...
Someone to give us permission.
And permission ain't coming. It's not, you know. It's just not coming. And this notion that a hero is going to arrive, the hero is not going to come. There's no hero. Like, you know, we are the heroes. And, you know, that's what I would be asking them. But then I would not be asking them that in such a, you know, like in 20 seconds.
I was going to say, that's a lot to explore, isn't it? It's both depressing and uplifting at the same time.
Well, there's not a hero coming externally to you. The hero is within you.
Yeah.
Mm.
I don't think that's depressing at all.
Oh, good.
Yeah, not at all. And what a lovely point to end this interview. Bryce, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. There's so much we could talk about.
Yeah, I feel like there's a million things we haven't managed to touch on, but...
But the beauty is we've got a fair bit there. So thank you again.
We won't, yeah.
Beauty is we've got a fair bit there.
Yeah. And it's a start. Thanks again, Bryce. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Really interesting interview and a perspective on Australian storytelling, which Bryce is such has such distinct ideas. So that was a really fantastic interview. Hope you enjoyed it.
Such strong opinions. And to be honest, I'm a bit blown away by just his depth of knowledge of different areas of Australian storytelling.
And I think it's the pride that he has as well in what he does. Is just, it radiates from him.
Yeah.
So off the back of that, Lauren Bailey, it's time for recommendations. We need a little sting, like recommendations.
A sting like that, but maybe but different.
Yeah, we'll work on it.
I do actually have a great recommendation. And the recommendation is, huge shout out to Andrea McKinnon this month because, A, she put me onto a great podcast that I mentioned at the top of the podcast.
Podcast.
And B, she also pointed my attention at Smart for a Girl Raw. So I bet you're wondering what that is, Nick.
I'm wondering.
Let me tell you, Smart for a Girl Raw is the brainchild of creative collaborators Imogen Banks and Alice Bell, which was designed to address the lack of opportunity for entry-level screenwriters in the television industry. So, of course, this has come out of Screen Australia's Gender Matters Brilliant Careers initiative, which I just think so awesome, this whole Gender Matters thing. I just keep hearing about all these great projects that have been made possible because, you know, because Screen Australia is committed to gender equality in the industry.
Committed to the cause.
And so the idea of this initiative is that Smart for a Girl Raw will teach 12 uncredited female writers how an idea is developed into a television series through the processes of a writer's room.
Great.
There's more information about it on the Endemol Shine website.
Yep.
And I'll put up a link for that. And of course, the first round of applications close 1st of December.
Right.
So, you know, you've got a little bit of time to get your story pitch ideas together, but you do basically pitch an idea to them.
That's great.
Get the process rolling.
I just love that it's uncredited too, because it kind of stops that wheel that happens of people that go, right, I've got a credit, and then all of a sudden go from strength to strength, and there's all these people that are fantastic that just don't have the credits, that can't get the opportunities. Great. Fantastic. Do you want to hear mine?
I would love to hear your recommendation, Nick.
Excellent. It's actually, it harks back to Podcast 12 guest Richard Baker, if you remember, investigative journalist Richard Baker. Well, we did post this on the Facebook page a little bit earlier in the month, but I think it's worth shouting out again. Richard has, it's basically a collaboration with The Age newsroom.
Yeah.
He has started a podcast, which is called Phoebe's Fall. And it's a podcast series about the short life of Phoebe Handsjuk. Now, the fall that they refer to is the 40-meter fall down a garbage chute that eventually killed Phoebe a few years ago. And it asked the question that everyone's been asking, really, about how did she actually get down there? It was in the news at the time, and it was finally sort of ruled that it was via misadventure that the coroner said that she died, which, it's one of those things, much like the Serial podcast, a lot of people didn't necessarily think that that was the case. And I think this podcast and what I've heard of it is really exploring this idea of whether there was something a bit more sinister that happened. But basically, Richard's been following that story for years, and he actually mentioned it to us way back when, that he was looking to do this podcast. So it's really great to see this come to life. It's really set up in a way that you do start to get quite involved in the case and in the story. It is on the Age website. Please go check it out. It's currently 3 episodes down of 6, but they're nice bite-sized pieces too, 30-minute episodes.
Is the aim of it to uncover more information about what really happened and hopefully bring that to a sense of peace or closure?
Yeah.
Like, well, peace is probably the wrong word.
Yeah, but I mean, already this podcast is starting to have effects on coronial inquests, as far as the amount that families can actually appeal decisions. Talk about the power of podcasting.
Wow.
It's really cool to see something like this is actually not only wonderful storytelling, but also changing society in a way that it can only be a positive. Check it out in your future month, Lauren. Check it out then, because I'd like to hear a little bit about what you're up to in this future month.
What am I up to?
Oh, it wasn't that hard of a question, Lauren Bailey.
Well, you're not in my head, so maybe it's not that hard for you. just continuing to figure life out as we talked about at the top of the podcast, and, you know, we are really coming into a time of the year where certain elements of the industry do close down. But there is something that I'm hoping to implement, and it goes back to this idea of I really feel the answers are within me. I think it's important to note that we still have 3 months of the year left. So we still have a quarter left. But I do want to go back to that special period of time called Christmas week, where I make a real practice of taking time for myself and setting my path for the year and just looking at where I'm at and doing a bit of analysis. What I wrote at the beginning of the year for what I wanted to achieve this year, going back to that sort of stuff, I have instigated a new journaling system this month, which I'll talk more. I'll talk more about it next month when I've figured out if it's working for me. Something I've been wondering about all year is if I can take a week at the beginning of the year for myself and give myself the time that I need and feel like I have the space and time to create the life I want to be living, then why can't I do that any time that I want to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Why do I need to wait 12 months to let that happen for me? So I guess when you ask me what I'm doing in the month ahead, it's continuing to figure out how I create that time and space for myself.
Mm. It's an ongoing thing, isn't it? It's just something you need to constantly police, for lack of a better word. It feels like you police it sometimes, doesn't it? It's like that thing that you've got to keep coming back to and going, hold on. Am I doing, living intentionally? Am I
the friendly police?
Yeah, correct.
And I should also say, obviously, I have got a special event to attend in Sydney.
Oh, yes.
So I will be up in Sydney, and I'm hoping to have a couple of meetings and do some stuff while I'm up there. So.
And go to the wedding of the year.
Yes.
Hashtag the Kane event. Get involved.
And speaking of the wedding of the year.
Yeah.
Nick.
My future month, is it?
Yeah, tell me about your month.
Well, getting hitched. That's what's happening this month. So that is exciting. That is massively exciting. As I spoke about family and the opportunity to sit down with family and friends, having said that, and really get everyone in the same space. You know, after moving from Melbourne 2 years ago, this is a really lovely opportunity to get everyone that I love in one space.
Yeah.
You know, so that's kind of cool. But funnily enough, directly after the wedding, around the 23rd of October, so maybe a week and a bit, I am actually coming down to Melbourne for a month. So that's where I'll be performing Shining City. And another exciting part of that, Lauren Bailey, is that we'll get to record a podcast in the same location.
And we have got a wonderful guest lined up for that podcast as well.
Well, drum roll now, please.
Drum roll.
We'll put that in later. Oh no, there it is. We will have the wonderful.
On the table.
We will have the wonderful.
That's why we need you to buy bookmarks
to help us with sound effects. We'll look next month. We have a very exciting guest. Her name is Diana Nguyen. She is a Vietnamese comedian, actor, social activist, superstar.
Person.
Yeah, amazing. She's got a heap of projects on the go and really excited to talk to her about a few different things because I've been friends with Diana for over 10 years now and she just had a show at Melbourne Fringe, a comedy festival early in the year, which is it's growing legs. It's just going from strength to strength. So we'll have a good chat to her around many, many different issues because her culture is a big part of what she does.
Yeah, so, and if anyone's keen for us to ask any particular questions in that interview, if there's anything you'd really like to know about Diana's journey as a storyteller, please feel free to tweet at us. It's @storytelling on Twitter and let us know what you'd like to hear.
And until that time, can you please go and check out all our channels, check out the website, check out about.me, Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud and iTunes.
And have a fantastic creative springtime storytelling month.
And also, don't forget the blog.
Remember
Cultural
the
Temperature
blog.
This month we're talking about the burning issues. So
I think we should call it the main issue. The burning issue just sounds slightly
wrong. Okay, we're calling it the main issue. So we'll be tackling all those big issues. So we look forward to speaking to you then.
Have a great month.
Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.